Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Less than a week into the war in Iraq, reporters today showered tough questions on Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld and White House Press Secretary Ari Fleischer. Their responses, even tougher. The administration's tone shifted from celebrating American air power and the rapid advance of U.S. troops to sharp exasperation with questions on its basic strategy. Did the White House and Pentagon bank too much on overawing Baghdad for a swift victory? Did they misjudge Iraq's military and its civilians? Has Washington sent enough troops to do the job tonight? On Point, U.S. troops on the offense, U.S. war planners on the defense. We begin with an overview of war progress. U.S. troops endured a big sandstorm outside Baghdad today. British troops grappled with Iraqi resistance in Basra. Charles Heyman is a former major in the British Army and is editor of Jane's World Armies. I asked him for his take on the war to date, what's working and what's not.
Well, first of all, we've got three columns heading north out of Kuwait, and the progress of those columns is certainly in the west. The column that's heading for Kabbalah and Najaf, that's quite astonishing. They're well ahead of schedule. They're farther ahead than we thought they'd go. The center column, the one going up through Nazira, that's had a lot of problems, but now it's on the move again and heading up towards Kut, about 100 miles from Nazira to Kut. And the eastern column, we think, has now got as far as Al Amara. So Baghdad threatened from three directions, but there is no doubt whatsoever that at some stage and very, very shortly, certainly the western column is going to have to stop. It's going to have to reorganize itself and regroup because it's faced across the Euphrates with probably a division of the Republican Guard. Now, that column has got to get across the Euphrates somehow. It's almost 90% certain that the Iraqis will blow the bridges in that area. And it's going to take them some time, A, to get across, and then B, to engage the Republican Guard on the other side. So don't expect an assault on Baghdad in 48 hours. It's going to take much, much longer than that. And as for the other two columns, well, it'll take them a few days yet to get into a position, really, I think, where they can really start to threaten Baghdad.
Charles Heyman, many questions arising in the U.S. today. First, on resistance by the Iraqi military, stronger than at least the public in the U.S. had been led to expect, and without the enormous surrenders that had been anticipated in many quarters. And then on the front of the reception by Iraqi civilians, whether U.S. troops are seen as liberators or invaders. How significant are these two things?
Well, first of all, I mean, the resistance is significant. There's no doubt about that. Everybody always expected there to be a lot of resistance in the sunny heartlands in between the Euphrates and the Tigris, south and north of Baghdad. What people didn't expect was that there was going to be quite a lot of resistance in the southern areas, and especially in southeast Iraq, where there is a Shiite majority. And that surprised everyone. And there is no doubt that these long supply lines coming out of Kuwait and feeding the three major coalition columns that are going north, they are under considerable threat from stay-behind parties, from Fedayeen, and from units of the Iraqi regular army. So that's a worry. And probably the answer is we haven't got enough troops in the rear areas.
That is, you're saying we haven't got enough to guard the long supply lines?
Absolutely. We haven't got enough troops to ensure security in the rear areas. And for that, you need lots and lots of probably quite lightly armed infantry who can get around very, very quickly, patrol the areas, guard all the convoys, look after the critical points, the bridges and passes and things like that. That's probably a weakness, and many of us are worried that the Iraqis will try and exploit that in quite a big way.
Of course, it's always said that the war plan is thrown out the window as soon as the war begins. But between these elements, the failure of Turkey to open up and allow U.S. ground troops through, the failure of the Iraqi military to fall apart in any significant degree, the mixed reception by civilians, these long supply lines, when you put all that together and you put yourself in the shoes of U.S. General or Secretary of Defense, how concerned are you?
Well, I think the generals themselves always expected this. No war goes smoothly. Everybody's done the staff college courses. Mm-hmm. Everybody's played the war games, and they're never easy. You're always thrown things that you never, ever expected. Nothing goes according to plan. And the generals won't be fazed by this. Almost certainly the generals are asking now for reinforcements. They want a lot more troops. The war will probably last longer than anyone thought. Certainly we'll be lucky to see Baghdad fall in under a month. If it does, then that's a huge bonus. There's also now going to be a follow-on campaign of pacification, because coalition troops will have to take over every single sizable town in Iraq, remove the Ba'ath Party, and then run it for a period of time. So it's going to be a bigger and more complicated campaign than the politicians wanted. But I think the generals probably are not fazed by this. They expected military operations to be unpredictable. They've probably told the politicians that, but most of the time politicians don't really listen.
What does it say about the approach, the strategy of lighter, faster warfare that Donald Rumsfeld has championed? Fewer troops, more technology, dive in, get it done, and be finished with it.
It's a great theory, but all the old soldiers will always tell you that the great maxim of military operations is the more that you use, the less you lose. You always go for overwhelming force. Using lightly equipped troops and trying to make the smash-and-grab type attacks, it's always a gamble. You don't know how clever the enemy are going to turn out to be on the day. So this one, it's got its difficulties. I have no doubt whatsoever that the coalition will prevail, but there's some hard fighting ahead.
And on the point of reinforcements, are those troops and material in pipeline to come into the field of combat here, or is there a waiting game that has to be played?
Well, I think what we're looking for here, we're looking for lightly armed, light infantry type troops for the rear areas. We're probably looking for more mechanized and armored troops. Now, we know that the 1st Cavalry is on the way, the 1st Armored's on the way, the 4th Infantry is coming round. Britain is probably going to have to reinforce and put some more troops in as well. But putting more troops, a lot more troops in, is a good insurance policy against what's going to go wrong next. There is something going to go wrong next. There always is. And you have to have that insurance policy on the ground to make sure that you can deal with it. Military operations are not just in case. Donald Rumsfeld sounds as though he's been infected with this Japanese idea of just in time. Military operations are all about just in case. You have to guard against every eventuality.
And what if the pacification, as you describe it, requires more time and more effort than has been so far envisioned? What if the U.S. troops are not ultimately received as liberators?
That's a big problem. That's the $64,000 question. I think at the end of the day, the ordinary Iraqi on the street will say, the war is over, let's try and get on with our lives. Now, there will be elements that have to be put down, elements that have to be hunted out, things like that. But it'll probably be a long, slow job.
Charles Heyman, you know this from the inside, talking with military people, but also from the public perception side. Is this the war that was advertised?
Certainly it wasn't advertised by the military like that. I mean, it was certainly, I think public expectations were hyped by the politicians. Now, don't get me wrong, this hasn't fallen apart by any means. Mm-hmm. It's going on, and the guys on the ground are doing well. They're doing better than I expected.
And thank heavens for that.
Yeah, better than I expected at this stage. But I think the politicians hyped it beforehand. The politicians did make it seem as though this was going to be some sort of a walkover. There'd be a shock and awe campaign that would last for 48 hours, and then everybody in Iraq would surrender, put the white flags up, and throw flowers at the troops coming in. I think they did give that impression, just about all of them, both in Washington and in London. And the chickens, when you start military operations, the chickens always come home to roost.
Charles Heyman is former major in the British Army and editor of Jane's World Armies. He spoke with me earlier from Shrewsbury, England. The Washington Press Corps is sometimes accused of treading lightly with administration officials to keep those front row seats in the briefing room, but not today. After a weekend of tough images from Iraq, reporters were this afternoon aggressive in holding officials' feet to the fire. And Ari Fleischer and Donald Rumsfeld were pushing right back. They drove home the assured outcome of the war on Iraq. But their day was no cakewalk as questions swirled. Did Washington bring the right war plan to Iraq? Did they soft sell the difficulty of this war? Is it time for tough questions on U.S. military strategy in Iraq? Or is it too early? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now is Stephen Walt, Professor of International Relations Affairs and Academic Dean of the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. Good evening and welcome, Stephen Walt.
Good evening.
Great to have you. And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News Analyst Jack Beattie, Senior Editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Steve.
Jack, take us in here. You got to see a lot of both of these press conferences today, and they were an exception to the rule. Describe the scene.
Well, essentially this second thought of the press that we've all been experiencing and that's been was in the papers today was put to Rumsfeld and General Myers at the Pentagon, and the reporters kept saying, "Is this the war that you advertised? Did you put expectations too high? Is this war too light? Was your strategy of, going with what you had rather than waiting for the 4th Infantry Division to arrive? Is that going to work?" The questions were increasingly skeptical. For once, the unflappable, well, I guess he isn't unflappable, but it seemed that Mr. Rumsfeld was exceedingly exercised by the general sort of incredulity in the air. And at points, he actually seemed to be making a contrast implicit between the reporters in the room and their skeptical questions and those other reporters who are with our forces in the field, mm-hmm. who are showing Americans the real face of this war. And if only you could listen to them, you'd know. That seemed to be the subtext. It was a defensive performance by the defense secretary, I thought.
Stephen Walt, Jack Beattie, let's get just a taste of that from the press conference this afternoon. Here's Donald Rumsfeld interacting with a reporter at the Pentagon.
Is it possible that you did raise expectations beyond reasonable levels by talking about a shock and awe campaign? I mean, wasn't the impression put out that 3,000 bombs were going to fall in the first 48 hours and the regime was going to collapse?
Not by me, not by General Myers.
Well, General Renoir came and gave a briefing along those lines.
Well, there were a lot of bombs dropped. The reality is that they were dropped on military targets and regime control targets, and they were not dropped on innocent men, women, and children.
If you may have created the impression in the public mind that this is going to be over in 4 days.
I thought I answered that. I certainly did not. General Myers certainly did not. Is it possible that someone might have said something that led some person to believe that? I suppose so. But realistic people, why would we have put in train the hundreds of thousands of people to go do this task if we thought it was going to be over in 5 minutes? I mean, it's just unrealistic.
Stephen Walt, we're listening. Give us some interpretation here. Who's being unrealistic? Are reporters taking a few days of sandstorms and the normal rough and tumble of war and getting all upset about it? Or was there a cakewalk promise that's not emerging?
Well, I think that there's a little bit of truth here on both sides. I mean, Secretary Rumsfeld is being a bit disingenuous. In the first 24 hours of the war, for example, there were various reports from the administration about how they were in touch with top Iraqi generals about possible surrender. There was a general sense that, we really know what we're doing here. And I think in the run-up over the last few months, although there were occasional statements made about how we shouldn't underestimate the task before us and things like that, the general tenor was that this was going to be relatively easy. And I'd like to say a little bit about the things that have gone wrong. At the same time, Rumsfeld is correct that it's a little bit early to start trying to keep score on this one. There have been lots of shifts in opinion, even within the media reporting. Sort of on Friday declaring things were going very smoothly, and by Sunday people starting to talk about setbacks. Mm-hmm. We're in the business of trying to conquer an entire country. That is always a difficult and problematic task. And if the administration perhaps oversold how easy it was likely to be and maybe fell victim to some optimistic expectations, at the same time we probably don't want to start passing too much judgment on the strategy this early in the game.
Stephen Walt, hold it there. We're going to come back and hear more from Donald Rumsfeld, from Ari Fleischer, from Stephen Walt here in the studio, and our own Jack Beattie. Listeners, we're talking about the Pentagon and the White House in the hot seat today. Tough questions about U.S. strategy in Iraq. Did Washington bring the right strategy to Iraq? And is it time for tough questions, or is it just too soon? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the Pentagon and the White House in the hot seat. Tough questions today about U.S. strategy in Iraq. Did the White House and Pentagon soft sell the difficulty of taking Iraq? Did they simply underestimate the job? Did they overestimate the readiness of Iraqi soldiers to surrender, of the Iraqi people to rebel? Is it just too soon to be asking tough questions? We're at 1-800-423-8255 tonight. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined in the studio by Stephen Walt, author of The Origins of Alliances and professor of international affairs at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, and now from Fort Lee, New Jersey, by Larry Korb, director of national security studies at the Council on Foreign Relations and assistant secretary of defense for the Reagan administration. Good evening and welcome, Larry Korb.
Nice to be with you.
It's great to have you. Larry, we've been listening to a little bit of the exchange that Donald Rumsfeld had with reporters today. Let's jump right in and hear some more. At the White House, following that briefing, Ari Fleischer stepped to the podium and got into a bit of rough and tumble himself.
Not until the president ordered war to begin and he addressed the American people last Wednesday did he prepare the public for what would be, in his words, a longer and more difficult military fight than many have predicted. Why didn't he do it sooner? And what does he believe the level of patience is of the American public? At what cost is the public prepared to pay for achieving this end?
Well, number one, I think the American people have fully understood all the way along that there is risk, that there is sacrifice. As the nation prepared for war, and the president was very overt with the country about that this could result in the use of force. I want to cite for you three specific instances in which the president laid it out rather explicitly going back in time. One was a week ago Monday, March 17th, where the president said, and I quote, "Americans understand the cost of conflict because we have paid them in the past. War has no certainty except the certainty of sacrifice. If Saddam Hussein attempts to cling to power, he will remain a deadly foe until the end." And then on Wednesday last week, March 19th, the president said, A campaign on the harsh terrain of a nation as large as California could be longer and more difficult than some predict, and helping Iraqis achieve a united, stable, and free country will require a sustained commitment. And then again Saturday in the president's radio address, he had a very similar message. So I dispute the premise. The president has said this consistently, and I think the American people have been prepared for this, and they understand the sacrifices that must be made in order to disarm the Iraqi regime.
Because given your precise preparation for a question like that, it seems
too easy to read, David.
I guess so. Well, maybe that means that there's some level of defensiveness, that perhaps the president is worried that the American public may be less patient than he advised them to be. Is that the case?
No, I just anticipate your questions well.
No, wait a second. All right, that's Bill. A dodge. Wait, well, this is wartime. That's a dodge of the question.
You're asking me why am I prepared to answer your questions?
No, that's not what I asked you. I asked you, does he feel that the public did not adequately bring up its expectation for what we were facing?
No, and as I answered your question at the very beginning, I said that the American people and the president's judgment had been well prepared for this, and the American people understood, as the president repeatedly, going back to September 12th, the United Nations talked about the possibility of the use of force. The American people understand it. When the president talks about the use of force, they understand that means that lives can be lost. The president made that perfectly plain in those remarks that I quoted to you.
Ari Fleischer in the hot seat today at the White House, a kind of questioning that we have not seen much of, at least not recently there. But today there was plenty of it for both him and for Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld. I'm joined tonight by Stephen Walt from Harvard's Kennedy School and Lawrence Korb, former Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Reagan administration. Larry Korb, what are you hearing here? I guess, did Washington come with the right plan to this war, and was it honestly sold to the American people? A lot has been said, as Ari Fleischer says. He quoted President Bush there, you know, three or four different ways, but of course there are many other statements you could cite. How do you read it?
Well, I think what people are raising a question about is the whole situation with the the 4th Infantry Division, which was supposed to come in through Turkey. And we let the ship sit for, 26 days off the Turkish coast before moving them down to the you know, to the Suez Canal down to Kuwait. And so it'll be 10 days before that 4th Infantry Division can get into action. And then there were quotes on the part of a lot of military leaders and administration officials about shock and awe that somehow or another, you know, our precision bombing, the overwhelming thing would, you know, just shatter the confidence of the Iraqi leadership and there would be, very little fighting. They also talked about the fact that we'd be greeted with open arms, you know, with people throwing flowers at our feet, particularly in southern Iraq, you know, when we came in. And those things have not turned out to be true. But I think Steve Walt is correct. I mean, if you take a look and step back, we sort of overreacted for the first couple of days in terms of how well it went and overreacted when you had some casualties. I think all things considered, it's going reasonably well, or as well as you could have expected. Mm-hmm. But again, even though the president did say that, there were lots of people on his team that were creating these other expectations.
Stephen Walt, how about it? Looking at these initial operations, share with us your view of what's gone right and what's gone wrong, and maybe project the longer-term implications of what the beginning tells us.
Victory in the short term, has never really been the issue here. I don't think anyone seriously believes that the United States is going to lose this and not going to win. But the way in which we win does have some long-term implications. As Larry just said, you know, shock and awe didn't work. It doesn't look good on television and didn't work. There haven't been large-scale civilian uprisings really anywhere yet. May happen, but hasn't happened yet. There also haven't been mass surrenders of the Iraqi army the way you saw in the first Gulf War, I think roughly 3,500 at most out of an army of 400,000. This is important because it doesn't augur well for the long term. First of all, it doesn't suggest that the post-war occupation is really going to be all that easy. We haven't discussed, you know, the potential for trouble up in the north with the Kurds, but we don't appear to be greeted as liberators, and that suggests that the occupation could be much more difficult. It also creates problems for world opinion. If this had really gone perfectly, if Iraq had fallen like a house of cards, the way some people suggested it might, that might have been a vindication for the administration's strategy. Now it looks like we really have a somewhat tough fight on our hands. There's going to be more civilian casualties. The Iraqi people don't seem to be welcoming us. That's going to make the people who oppose this war, both of the United States and abroad, wonder if it was a war we really had to fight. So it does have some long-term implications, even though I think the ultimate outcome is not in doubt.
Ultimate outcome of the attack to take over Iraq, but then you're looking beyond that and saying that's where maybe you have to read the oracle bones of the beginning here and learn something.
I think that it, again, this is early days, but so far we're not seeing the set of developments that would make you think, gee, this was a regime that had no basis for support. This is a people that really was crying out for liberation. This is a place where it's going to be easy to install some kind of workable government. Rather, it looks like a country that's going to be in deep, deep trouble when we're done with it, is going to resent our presence to some degree. And that, again, makes the future look much more problematic than we might have hoped for going in.
Larry Korb, do you agree with Steve Walt's assessment? And if you do, were these misjudgments on Washington's part, or was this marketing that led to a framing that may not have been entirely accurate?
Well, I think it depends on who you say Washington. I think on the part of some people in the administration, particularly some of the civilian leaders in the Pentagon and on the vice president's staff, they were the ones, I think, that were, you know, over-optimistic. The military, I don't think, ever bought, you know, into this. In fact, the military had to knock Rumsfeld down, almost kicking and screaming and leaking to the papers last summer because their initial plan called for something, you know, sending like something like 50,000 ground troops
super light
in there. And so there are some people in the administration who I think were over optimistic and thought we would be greeted as liberators. But Steve is right on. The real question is not who can win the war. The real question is how long will we have to be in Iraq to keep it stable? How difficult will it be? And you know, this idea of, you know, turning it into a democracy at some point, and they have a, you know, domino theory in the Middle East. Those, I think, are really called into question by the way this military campaign has gone on. And what I worry about is, and Steve and John Mearsheimer have been really out front, and I think their ideas that they've written about this, by undertaking this war, in effect, it is not that great. Iraq was not that great a threat to national security. Will we have the stomach to deal with Korea, for example, after this? Or what will happen? What will the Iranians do? Will they get nuclear weapons now so they won't have to be the next domino on the axis here?
It's more than we can take in tonight, but we're looking closely at Iraq and the way Rumsfeld had to answer for the early days this afternoon. Let's get another slice of the briefing where, again, reporters were hounding the Secretary of Defense.
This expectations question, the DIA director a couple weeks ago said in a press interview that while the Pentagon is preparing for stiff resistance, there is a very real likelihood that resistance could collapse very quickly. A couple days before that, Vice President Cheney said that he did not expect a long, bloody fight and that even significant elements of the Republican Guard are likely to step aside. At this point in the conflict, do any of those predictions seem to be bearing out?
Well, I would say, given the fact that we're 200-plus miles inside Iraq at this time, on the doorstep of Baghdad, that we really haven't engaged on the ground the Republican Guard division. So we've put helicopters against them, attack helicopters. We've put air against them. We've put some artillery against them. But we haven't engaged them in a classic battle. So their mettle has yet to be tested. We're going to have to find out.
Let me just make a comment on this. It keeps coming back up about expectations. Analysts say what they say. And quite honestly, they seem to me to be all over the lot. They're not all in one little box of it'll be over in 15 minutes. If some analyst wants to say it's going to be a cakewalk and it turns out not to be a cakewalk, the fact of the matter is we have said repeatedly we can't say how long it will last. We do not know. It is not knowable. I've said I don't know how many times. Days, weeks, or months. Don't know. Same thing like the cost. I noticed today everyone was saying, oh my goodness, they did know what the war is going to cost. And I have said repeatedly, we don't know what the war is going to cost. And the truth is, we don't know what the war is going to cost. You can't know it. It's not knowable. The budget figure the president announced up there is not the cost of the war. The budget figure he announced up there is the cost of some money the state needs, some money the CIA needs, some money that Homeland Security needs, some money that this department needs to carry us from the beginning of the global war on terrorists starting October 1st of this fiscal year through where we are today and hopefully through the rest of the year, and some money to flow forces overseas. And we can't tell you. If you can't tell how long it's going to last, you sure can't tell what it's going to cost. But now... Now, if people have a tendency to want to gravitate towards some analyst's expectation, which is unreasonable, which may be unreasonable, given the fact we're 4 days into it, it's a little early to know if it's unreasonable, but let's pretend it's unreasonable, then I would not follow that analyst, and I would try to listen to what we're saying from this podium as to what we think.
Donald Rumsfeld, hot under the collar today at a Pentagon briefing where he was getting a fairly rough going over by the press corps there. Stephen Walt, the Secretary of Defense here, lays it off on unnamed analysts who were, off the reservation, talking poppycock, who can control what they say. Is it fair of him now to lay the cakewalk expectations entirely outside the Pentagon?
Well, no. In fact, if you recall, the reporter's question specifically quoted the vice president, who's not just some analyst, right? He also quoted the head of the Defense Intelligence Agency, again, not just some beltway analyst. Also, you notice he got very defensive about the budget figure here. This is a place where I think, the administration's credibility is a little bit questionable here. I mean, obviously, no one knows what the full cost of the war is, but the administration refused to give Congress any estimates even of what it might cost for a few months. And then suddenly, 4 days into the war, they come forward and say, well, we know it'll cost for the next 6 months at least. We know what extra we need. Budgetary planning of this sort is not that sophisticated. And I think in this case, you really sort of have to ask, were they being sincere? The other issue here, though, this is a democracy. Mm-hmm. And asking tough questions, it strikes me as totally appropriate, both before you go to war and once you're in a war and you expect the civilian and military leaders to have good answers and to admit when there's things they don't know, but at least to try and come clean on this. One of the issues I think that now we're starting to see some waking up to is that there were some significant slips in the administration's credibility beforehand, and this may not have caused a lot of problems here at home, but certainly caused problems overseas.
Such as?
They never made the link between Iraq and al-Qaeda in a way that convinced anyone who wasn't already on board. More importantly, they continued to argue that Iraq really had a nuclear development program, despite the fact that the UN inspectors not only found no evidence in Iraq, but when they investigated the specific accusations about aluminum tubes and attempts to buy uranium, these were shown to be false. Now, the administration kept making these claims as late as a couple of weeks ago, but they'd been pretty badly discredited. So if we're seeing slightly tougher questioning now, that's probably a good thing, regardless of one's views on how the war is going or whether or not we should be fighting it.
Jack Beatty, you heard Donald Rumsfeld's protests all day. You know, don't tell us that this is what we said, somebody else said, analysts said it. And yet a lot of these words were in the mouths of administration officials. I wonder, were they trapped by their desire to spook Baghdad in advance of war, to just scare the daylights out of them so that they might crack under the pressure? Or could this have been a kind of bait and switch on the American public?
Well, I think somewhere in between there, I want to think that this was part of a kind of propaganda war, that we were going to show them, quote, a war like they've never seen before. Well, apparently we haven't. And, someone asked a question to Rumsfeld today that brought out that, in a way, you can call Rumsfeld the reverse Colin Powell. The Rumsfeld Doctrine seems to be almost the reverse of the Powell Doctrine. The Powell Doctrine, which we used to great success in 1991, was overwhelming force. And this questioner pointed out that we did not engage with the Republican Guard then until we had degraded by bombing its armor by 50%. And no one is making such claims now. So that was kind of like I was awoken and I said, my gosh, there's a benchmark. What was so different about, why are we so much more, you know, why isn't there, how come there's nothing like that going on now? And why didn't they think about this? And, you know, in a way, we have Donald Rumsfeld here. I mean, he made a bad judgment in Afghanistan. I mean, the judgment that let essentially bin Laden escape possibly from Tora Bora, he was involved in that.
By using Afghan troops to close
right.
in.
And we didn't want to put too many boots on the ground, and we wanted to use that judgment was a bad judgment. And you can almost sort of see his reaction to the Afghan war, according to Bob Woodward, when the first plans were being made, he says, my God, the CIA is running this. They're doing all the bribes. We're supposed to be running this war. Well, now he's got a war of his own to run. And I just feel that the failure to get Turkey in on our side here was among the most signal diplomatic failures in probably modern times.
To permit the ground troops to come in through Turkey and open
then
a second front.
You get another 60,000 men in the field coming from the north, dividing the Republican Guard, and that failure just sticks out there. And you know, why was that failure? Well, all sorts of reasons, some of them having to do with Turkish politics, but I've read accounts that the vice president got into was kind of browbeating the Turkish president over the phone.
Jack Beatty, stand by. We're talking about the Pentagon and the White House in the hot seat today. Tough questions today about U.S. strategy in Iraq. War is never what you expect. Is this close enough to what was described? Or is this just a bunch of nervous Nellies in the media and armchair retired generals second-guessing a good plan? Did the White House and Pentagon soft-sell the difficulty of taking on Iraq? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are talking tonight about the Pentagon and White House in the hot seat. Tough questions today about U.S. strategy in Iraq. And we ask you as well, did Washington bring the right strategy to Iraq? Is it time for tough questions or is it too soon? Do you smell the Bush administration on the defensive or just hunkering down to do a job? We're at 1-800-423-8255. 1-800-422-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guest tonight, Lawrence Korb, joining us from Fort Lee, New Jersey, former Assistant Secretary of Defense for Ronald Reagan, and in the studio with me tonight, Stephen Walt, Academic Dean at the Kennedy School of Government and Professor for International Affairs. You can join the conversation as well. Bill is calling from Brookline. Hi, Bill. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. What I smell is I smell the press having an absolute fit over any time they're shooting in their general vicinity. We've taken a grand total of, I think, 50 casualties, including accidents.
Right.
We're sitting on the outskirts of Baghdad 6 days after this thing started. We remind you, in World War II, the big race across France, we made 10 miles a day. That was considered a race. We're not taking a lot of casualties.
So it's looking good. It's looking so far so good to you, Bill.
Oh, it so far looks about as good as you would expect. There's 22 million people in Iraq. Can you imagine what the resistance would be if you invaded something like, say, Texas?
And let me just ask you, what about these issues? We haven't seen the big surrenders. We haven't seen definitively civilian uprisings. Do you take those as disturbing markers, or that's just the way it is? So what?
Well, first of all, Bush the First, to our eternal shame, left the Iraqis in the southern and northern parts of the countries hanging out to dry in 91, and they certainly remember that.
And a lot of blood was shed.
And secondly, they're not forward deploying their troops. This is not the Kuwaiti war. This is a different war. And the troops are not deployed in such a way that we can, you know, take them out piecemeal the way we did in the first war. We're just now starting to engage the Republican Guards. We're engaging them by air. We're hitting them with B-52s. We're hitting them with Apaches. We'll be in direct engagement sometime soon.
So you look out there, Bill, and it's looking good to you. Let me put it to our guest, Larry Korb. How do you see it when we've made this great an advance, this many miles in so few days, sitting on the outskirts of Baghdad? Is the rest all yammering?
Well, I think Bill is right, and I think all of us have said that in one way or another, that standing back and looking at it from a military point of view, it is going as well as could be expected. The problem is that the administration, created different expectations, and as Steve pointed out, winning the military battle is not the hard part. The hard part is winning the peace and rebuilding Iraq. And the way in which things have developed, it looks like that's going to be harder than they had told us. You know, talking about the budget, for example, I looked at that budget today. There's $2.5 billion in there for rebuilding Iraq. It's going to cost you a lot more than that. And I think the American people had a right to know ahead of time what the bill would be. And back in 1991, when we passed the hat to get people to contribute, we had an estimate before the war started. We collected all that money before the war started.
$60 billion plus.
Yeah, and we could have done that ahead of time. And this is what the democracy is about. I mean, they should have told us the cost so we could weigh the cost both in terms of lives and money and the long-term cost. Look what happened when General Shinseki, the Army Chief of Staff, said he thinks that 200,000 people will be required to, you know, hold Iraq together and to occupy Iraq after the war. And they said, oh, you know, they come up and said he doesn't know what he's talking about. You know, he's way off. Well, they must have had something in mind then, you see, when they were doing it. And if you take a look at the way the military campaign has gone so far, it looks like General Shinseki's number is a lot closer than theirs would be.
Steve Walt, what about it? Is this a kind of standard volume of political obfuscation in advance of war to get the country to buy in, or are we seeing something unusual here in the way it was presented in advance? Whatever the success and progress of it to date, as our caller Bill points out.
Yeah, countries rarely go to war unless they're somewhat optimistic, and political leaders who've decided on war, and in this case we now have a pretty good journalistic account suggesting that the decision for war was actually made back in March or April of last year. Mm-hmm. Everything else was, in a sense, getting everyone ready for it and trying to prepare the diplomatic campaign. This was something of a sales job. I think that becomes clear. But the caller makes a very valid point that, you know, this is very early on. And when you're attempting to conquer a country, if we get to the end of this and we've lost a few hundred people, that's tragic in an individual sense, but would be an extraordinarily impressive military campaign. I think there are three big questions looking forward that you want to keep your eyes on. First of all, do the Republican Guards hold together and fight well? If they collapse rapidly, then obviously things get much simpler.
In 1991, they held together, whether or not they fought well.
Correct. Second, is there a battle for Baghdad? Urban warfare negates many of our advantages, not all of them by any means, but many of them. It puts the two fighting forces on a somewhat more even footing, and it also involves civilians because they're commingled with the forces there. So is there really a street fighting battle for Baghdad? Again, that would be difficult for us. And finally, what happens up in the north? What happens with the Kurds? Larry Korb has emphasized the fact that we didn't get an agreement to go in from the north, but we also don't have an agreement with the Turks to stay out. And if you want a real nightmare scenario, it's the possibility of the Kurds declaring independence, declaring autonomy, the Turks coming in, and the United States trying to mediate between those two groups. Those would be the three big things looking forward. You know, the Republican Guards, the battle for Baghdad, and what happens in the north.
Could be ugly. On the other hand, could work. The situation at the press conference today was not only focused on the very large picture, but to some extent on what's going on right now. Let's listen here to an exchange where Donald Rumsfeld is questioned again on the disbursement of troops and whether or not the supply lines are adequately protected.
Mr. Secretary, you said yourself a moment ago that this operation could become more dangerous for U.S. and Allied troops in the coming days as you approach Baghdad. There are Sunday morning generals in every war, and critics are coming out of the walls to criticize this ground campaign. They say that your imprimatur of transformation is heavily on it, and that there are simply not enough troops and armor on the ground right now to efficiently take Baghdad or protect your rear. How would you answer that, sir?
First of all, I don't know how anyone outside of the government thinks they know what my views are or what General Frank's views are or what General Myers' views are. We've all been deeply involved, and the plan has been a plan that's been approved by all the commanders and by, needless to say, General Myers and General Pace and Don Rumsfeld and the President of the United States. And it is a good plan, and it is a plan that in 4.5 or 5 days has moved ground forces to within a short distance of Baghdad. And forces increase in the country every minute and every hour of every day, and that will continue to be the case. There is a force flow that's been put in place weeks and weeks and weeks ago where people were mobilized, people were trained, equipment was loaded on ships, ships were leased, ships were sent over, ships moved into position, ships were unloaded, personnel were airlifted over to meet with their equipment. And every hour, the number of U.S. and coalition forces in that country are increasing. So how I would respond to what you say are some folks who are concerned about that is that the people who are involved in this, General Franks and General McKiernan and General DeLong and General Abizaid and Admiral Keating, General Mosley, are very comfortable, as are the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who have met with the President twice in the last 2 days and discussed it.
Donald Rumsfeld today at the Pentagon. Lawrence Korb, is this a fair response? It's fairly well known that there was a big debate within the Bush administration about whether to go in with a heavy Gulf War I-sized troop base here, 500,000 troops or so. That put up against, as you or Stephen Walt pointed out, this kind of real military transformation guys who thought about going in high-tech, and with just 50,000 we came to a kind of compromise. Have we ended up? Do we see ourselves now light on the ground? Do we wish we had another couple hundred thousand troops there?
Well, I think the real issue is the Northern Front and the 4th Infantry Division. I think that's what the question we asked this guy by the name of Charlie Allinger. That was his question that he asked Don Rumsfeld.
And the 4th Infantry being the one that hasn't barked because it's still not in theater because it couldn't get in through Turkey.
Well, that's right. And then they let the ship stay there for another 3 weeks, hoping for whatever, and didn't move them down into position. And I think that's the real issue, because the original plan that Rumsfeld and the chiefs approved was the three divisions, one Marine division and two, you know, relatively heavy Army divisions. And that was the plan. Well, right now you've only got two in there plus the 101st Airborne. And that's what I think people are getting to. Should we have waited another week or 10 days before we started the war to get that 4th Infantry Division into position in the south, in case we needed it.
But Stephen Wall, is the fact that we went ahead without that a nod to the kind of military transformation and light military that whatever Donald Rumsfeld says in this answer, he has been on the record as promoting?
He certainly has, and I think, you know, against some resistance within the officer corps, senior leadership of the armed forces. I don't think we're seeing a campaign that is the pure model that you might have envisioned when people talked about, you know, the special forces with satellite uplinks riding horses through Afghanistan. I mean, that was more of the image you had. This is a
light on the ground, heavy from the air, high tech.
That's right. But we have a sizable number of forces there, perhaps not as many as some military officers would like, but it's not going in there with a handful of people either. The other point I'd make here is that no one is going to admit, particularly in the context of wartime, that there's been significant disagreements between the civilian leadership and the uniformed services. But there have been plenty of journalistic accounts suggesting some reservations and some deep divisions over the plan. And a point to observe here is the American military is loyal and heroic and responsive to its civilian masters, but they generally prefer, not surprisingly, to have more rather than less. As I think the interviewer that began the show, began this segment, suggests, you know, generally you want to go in with more than you think you need because you want to be prepared for surprises.
But being willing to go in with less seems kind of part and parcel of preemptive war. If you're going to be intervening more often, you don't want to have to move 500,000 troops each time. Steve Walt, stand by. I want to get a call from Stacy in Jacksonville, North Carolina. Hi, Stacy. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hello.
Yeah, I just had a comment. I was listening to the show, and my husband is over there somewhere outside of Kuwait, and I just wanted to agree with, you know, from what I've heard when I've been able to watch television and stuff, I feel like everything that the administration has been saying from the beginning has led us to believe that this is going to be over quick. You know, I personally feel a lot of anxiety. Since my husband's been gone, I'm feeling like, you know, I want him to come home.
So, Stacy, even for you, with a firsthand kind of awareness of the military, felt that this would be faster than what you're expecting now?
Yeah, it was. And, you know, what I hear from a lot of people, just listening to people who don't even know my husband's over there, everybody's like, you know, I just hope it'll be over quick. I hope it's over soon. I hope it's quick. I hope there's a quick end. Mm-hmm. It seems like it's just really created a lot of anxiety, and we really weren't aware going into it. You know, it's common sense. It is a war. You really can't say how long a war is going to last. But right. I think we kind of went into it a little overconfident, believing it was just, we were just going to go in there and they were just going to fall down like a domino effect. And that hasn't happened. And it's very uncertain what is going to happen. And I'm not worried. You know, I know my husband is in God's hands. I'm not worried about that. Whatever happens, and I feel like we're doing the right thing, going over and trying to liberate these people and free them from the grasp of an evil man. I think that it would be wrong of us to stand by and watch it happen.
On the other hand, you could feel a little more confident tonight. You'd like to. We hear that. Stacy, we don't want to heighten your anxiety, but I guess it's time to look at it in a clear-eyed way, and we hear what you're feeling on that front. Jack Beatty, here's the wife of a serviceman at the front, feeling that the signal she got earlier was quick. It would be quick.
Yeah, I've got a relative there, too. And, you know, it's a hard question, but we have to ask if, you know, are these people more vulnerable than they would be if that other division was there? And each American life is precious. And was this strategy rushed? Or delayed too long, as Larry suggested, and with what consequences for our servicemen? This is a grave question, and I think what happens in this big battle with the Republican Guard is going to, it could well provoke some leaks out of the Pentagon. I suspect that will be very unflattering for Mr. Rumsfeld. Perhaps I'm wrong about that. You know, when Rumsfeld was asked later on about, what do you think about the Fedayeen, Saddam Fedayeen, falling in behind and sort of, you know, picking away at our supply lines? And his comment on it was, well, you live with it.
You live with it, or if you're there, maybe you don't. Jack, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
Well, it was a war that was sold and sold hard, and we hope everything goes just as well as it can go, but there will clearly be questions as we go forward. Stephen Wald, I want to thank you for being with us tonight. It's been great having you.
Nice to be here.
Stephen Wald is academic dean of the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard and professor of international affairs there. He's author of The Origins of Alliances. And Lawrence Korb, thank you for joining us tonight.
Nice to be with you.
Lawrence Korb is director of national security studies at the Council on Foreign Relations and was assistant secretary of defense for Ronald Reagan. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.